Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames, the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Returning to the show is none other than Dan Rayner. Dan, welcome back.
You can't see it, but I'm taking a little bow right now.
Well, I see it, and I love it. I love it, every second of it. And we've got Dan back on the show because we're going to be doing another Kubrick movie.
I take a lot of honor in the fact that I'm the Kubrick expert on the show.
This is only just started this year. You started off the year. You kicked off Missing Frames in 2019 with Paths of Glory, which neither of us had seen. And now we're doing Barry Lyndon, which I have never seen. I've owned the Criterion Blu-ray for, God, a little while now, and I've just never seen this movie.
We've been, I don't know, this is spoiling the behind the scenes, but we've been talking about doing this movie for a while.
We have.
Just because I adore this film. I've seen it 3 or 4 times.
Do you remember the first time you saw it and what the circumstances were? Because we also, I think people have probably maybe listened to other episodes where we've talked about Kubrick, but let's talk about your love for Kubrick, because he's your favorite filmmaker.
He is. I can't remember the exact first time I saw this movie, but I remember I'd seen, you know, the kind of standard Dr. Strangelove, 2001, you know, the film school kind of classic, Clockwork, and people kept talking about this movie, Barry Lyndon, and I'm a camera guy. I do that for a living. And the main thing they talked about was the camera work and the cinematography, and these special lenses that were used for a scene where the entire scene was shot by candlelight. And back during the moon landing, NASA contracted Zeiss Optics, which is a major optics and lens company, to make lenses that were sensitive enough to light to use in cameras shooting on the moon. And they're very special, like, beautiful lenses. There's nothing quite that good out there for low light ever made again. They made 5 lenses. 2 went to NASA, 2 went to Kubrick, and 1 is housed at the museum at Zeiss's headquarters in Germany.
And is this the only time they used those lenses on a film?
It was the first time, and now through some sort of company through the Kubrick estate, you can technically rent them. I don't know. They must be exorbitant, but I'm going to get a little bit technical here, but when you have a lens, there's 2 numbers to keep in mind. You have your focal length, which is how wide the frame is. So a 10 millimeter lens is very wide. 100 millimeters is very kind of zoomed in, very tight. The other number to keep in mind is the f-stop, which refers to how much light the lens lets in. So the smaller the number, the more light it lets in. Your average lens is about, you know, anywhere from a 1.4 to a 2.8, you know, in terms of how much light it lets in.
Right.
The lenses used for that scene are a 0.7, which is in terms of speed, which means how much light they let in, they're the fastest
that's
ever
amazing.
Made. And yeah, it's an amazing achievement in engineering. There's a lot of like interesting lens choices in the movie. Kubrick was a photographer before he was a filmmaker, and he even modified his camera to accept these specialty lenses for this.
So did you seek this movie out? Was it something that you were like, I have to see it? Or was it something that was shown to you, like in film school or by somebody else?
I don't remember the exact circumstances the first time I watched it. I think just all that technical talk about it, I was like, I've never heard of this movie. Like, it's not one that's talked about when people talk about Kubrick. In my opinion, it's kind of like the Jackie Brown. If you've seen Jackie Brown.
Yes.
So with Tarantino, he made Pulp Fiction. He made Kill Bill Part 1. And then he came out with Jackie Brown.
And Jackie Brown was after Pulp Fiction. It was before Kill Bill Volume 1.
Right.
So it was like people were waiting for the follow-up to Pulp Fiction.
And then
Jackie Brown comes out, and it's kind of odd. Not bad, but different.
And this movie came out right after Clockwork Orange, which is kinetic and wild and shot very, you know, it's a very weird, dark, disturbing film.
And kind of, it's a dystopian future, whereas this is like Victorian, elegant past.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here. This is my favorite Kubrick movie in terms of cinematography.
Oh, wow.
And that's saying a lot, but it's every frame looks like a Rembrandt painting, the use of light. And my favorite aspect, he uses a lot of zoom lenses, which before this movie, even like they weren't considered, they were considered kind of punkish, like The Graduate used them. They were very kind of new wave cinema, very kind of loose. They weren't considered classical cinematography tools. But the way he uses them, every frame from a long zoom move that he does works as a frame. It just reveals more information and makes the frame more complex and interesting.
Yeah.
He has one lens that's a 24 to 400 millimeter zoom.
Good God.
And you start out with something really, you know, a small detail of the frame. It just keeps going back and back and back. And every few seconds, a new element will add a depth to the framing that wasn't there in the initial part of the zoom, which I just love.
We've talked about it before. Again, you can check out other episodes. We did Paths of Glory. That was the first episode we did this year, and we both love that. But, you know, I'm a huge Kubrick fan, mm-hmm. and I love 2001. I love Doctor Strange. I mean, all these movies. And Barry Lyndon just never watched it. I had plenty of opportunities to watch it, but I think something about the time frame turned me off. I've never been a huge fan of that period of time. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just the style of clothing, but something about it feels so awkward and stiff and formal to me that I've never really... I think I saw photos from this movie and was just like, I don't want to watch this movie. I don't care about these people.
I think we mentioned this before we started recording, but if you like, and I know you do, novels kind of from that era, like classical, you know, 19th century, 18th century novels, where, you know, there's bigger ideas going on with a simple story and, you know, kind of a different way of speaking, but still humanity to it, I think you'll enjoy this.
Yeah.
It definitely is a lot slower paced than a lot of his movies, but it to me, the visuals just make up for it. Every frame, you just kind of drink in as a painting.
Dan, this movie is 3 hours long.
It is.
What are you doing to me? What have you done?
It's a testament to the visuals that it never feels its length. It's never... It's long and slow, and they talk in, you know, kind of an old sort of style of speaking, but it never feels...
Damn you. Damn you, Dan. It's 9 o'clock at night. It's a Friday, thank God. But, man, I am looking forward to watching this movie. It has been in my collection for a little while. I've been wanting to watch it. I am... looking forward to it, and I was doing a little bit of research without trying to spoil the movie for myself, but like every other Kubrick movie released around this time, after Dr. Strangelove, every Kubrick movie was met with, like, completely mixed receptions. From 2001 to The Shining, it baffles me to say this, but The Shining was nominated for Razzies. I think it was the first year the Razzies existed. Kubrick got nominated for Worst Director for The Shining. Let's just try to, sit on that,
wow.
People. Let's meditate on that a moment. But I found in the research that Barry Lyndon was the same situation. Lots of people kind of responded pretty negatively, but people were kind of indifferent to it. And only in recent years has its reputation kind of grown.
I feel like with Kubrick, it's kind of like when you listen to a new album by a really brilliant artist and it doesn't quite gel with you. It's not what you expected. It's different and it's difficult. But, you know, third or fourth listen through, you get it and it's brilliant. I feel like any great artist, when they try something new or they go a new direction or they're constantly innovating and doing something new, it always takes a minute for it to really sink in and really be considered a great. And I think Kubrick's no exception.
Did you get this right away? Was it something where you connected to it immediately, or did it take some more time for you to get into it?
I feel like every time I watch it, I find new elements with it. The first time I was just dazzled by how gorgeous it looked. The more I've watched it, the more I've realized the larger kind of philosophical themes going on in it. And I'm kind of fascinated by that. But it's slow and it's long, but it just never feels boring.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, 2001 A Space Odyssey, one of the jokes
exactly.
about that is a friend of mine who hated the movie had scared me away from watching 2001 for the longest time because he described it as the most boring piece of crap he'd ever seen. And when I watched it, I found it, like, utterly captivating and hypnotizing.
Yeah.
And there's something about Kubrick's pacing, his slow pacing, that is still, because, like you said, he's such a master of his craft,
yeah.
that you were so pulled into it, and even if very little is actually happening, it's almost so much is happening, whether it's in the sound or the visuals or just the combination of the two, it is just completely captivating.
It feels almost as if Kubrick was trying to capture the way stories were told at that time and doing it in a medium that obviously the great writers of that era didn't have access to. And, you know, it feels Dickens, it feels Dostoevsky, it feels like Tolstoy. It's, you know, a big kind of epic story that, you know, is a lot about mood and a lot about kind of deep ideas told through simple characters and human struggles, but at a pace of a great novel from that era. We'll probably talk more about this after we watch the movie.
Yeah.
But.
So where does it rank in terms of favorite films and also in Kubrick's filmography for you?
I think we've talked about this before. Ranking Kubrick films is very difficult because each one really just is apples and oranges. Like, you can't compare Full Metal Jacket to Dr. Strangelove. Like, they're nothing alike. It's underrated and underseen, and I think that's kind of a crime. I keep harping on the visuals, but just from that perspective, I think in terms of the look, I think it's his best in terms of what he was able to accomplish through the camera. And again, that's high praise, you know, when we talk about his movies, but
yeah,
I'll say that much about it.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to watch it. I'm going to make some coffee. And we're going to do this. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And we're going to come back and talk about it after we're done.
You've been listening to Kubrick Corner. That's Corner with a K with Dan Rayner and Sean Eastridge. We'll see you in a bit, folks.
Oh, I hate you.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Dan, this movie is so long. It is so long. It is now 12:30 in the morning.
it didn't feel its length till the very end, it's definitely, we probably should have started earlier.
Well, it's not boring though.
Oh no,
it's not boring. But it is. It reminded me a lot of Full Metal Jacket in that it's divided very specifically into two halves.
Yep.
And the same way I feel about Full Metal Jacket. The first half of this movie, I was completely engaged. I was on board and I was involved in the story. And then the second half kind of lost me and I wasn't sure where it was going. And it kind of meanders a bit and then it concludes and I'm just left feeling exhausted.
Oh, no. So the thing that I immediately, well, first of all, before we get into the plot and the specifics, what did you think of the cinematography?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, yeah. Technically and visually, the movie's stunning.
My favorite shot is the one of him at the very end when it looks very much like a Rembrandt, where it's just that natural light falling on him and he's like passed out in a chair and just everything's placed perfectly. It looks like a painting.
Yeah.
And there's so many shots in this look like paintings.
There's that channel, every frame a painting?
Yeah.
The video channel? I think that applies to Barry Lyndon.
Oh,
I think
definitely.
Maybe that phrase was invented specifically for Barry Lyndon.
I stand by saying it's his most beautiful film. It really is.
I loved the fact that he used natural lighting, or there was such a... I think there is some instances where they did use artificial, but for the most part, you can tell... It's natural.
Well, the candle scenes, I remember reading about how the difficulty, because they had so many candles, everything in the nighttime interiors was lit entirely with candles, and the amount of smoke they put off and like protecting these like ancient houses they're filming in, like just so many complications, but it feels so authentic. It feels like it's how it would look if you lived in that time. And the attention to detail is stunning. The one noticeable scene, there's obviously instances where they used artificial lighting to enhance things, and even some of the daytime scenes, I would imagine they used special lights for that just to get the lighting just right. The one that stands out as somebody who works in, you know, the movies and stuff, is when Miss Lyndon goes out on the porch.
Yeah.
Moonlight does not look blue, and it's white, and it, you know, it's a blue light on her. But I mean, again, like it's beautifully shot. You can't fault it for, you know, enhancing the look here and there.
Well, what was amazing about it is, I mean, really the first half of the movie, I was so captivated, and part of it was because storytelling wise, it kind of threw me off reading about people saying, oh, this movie feels so cold and detached. Mm. Now I understand it having seen the whole movie, but for the first half, it feels like one of the more passionate and almost heartfelt projects Kubrick has done. It's almost, I wrote down a note, it feels kind of like a comedy for a good chunk of the first half. Like, I was laughing a lot, and a lot of the beats are played almost comedically.
Yeah.
And the relationships and kind of the formality of everybody in the film is very, it's so stiff and structured, but it's done in a way that feels very funny.
And the thing that I, and this might sound really weird, but I'll explain. I view this as a companion film to Clockwork Orange. And I know stylistically it's very different, but both films center around this idea of social control of human desire. With Clockwork, you have an out of control, you know, completely anarchic character, Alex, who is, you know, conditioned to be controlled by this bureaucratic state apparatus. In Barry Lyndon, it's the height of the Enlightenment era Europe, and they mention King Frederick, who was directly influenced by the Enlightenment, and just the precision of the military, and just the very rigid rules for love, and the wedding scene. They're talking about how marriage is not to satisfy a man's carnal lust, is to produce children.
Yeah, it's the polar opposite of Clockwork Orange.
And keep men from fornication. And the kind of beauty of it is it shows how human emotion can't be controlled like that. And every major thing that moves the plot forward is an outburst of human emotion, from his first love early on in the film, to him beating his horrible stepson in front of everybody.
Though to be fair, his horrible stepson has good reason to be horrible to him, because Barry Lyndon's pretty terrible.
It's interesting because a lot of thinkers around this era kind of theorize that if everybody followed his best logical interests, everything would turn out fine. And Barry Lyndon, the character, he's slimy, he's not a good person, but he does follow his own, you know, logical interest throughout the whole film, and it brings him nothing but ruin. And it's an interesting kind of commentary on that, because he wastes all this money, he destroys this estate for very logical, sound reasons to, you know, secure himself a position and, you know, kind of make him ingratiate himself as a lord in the system. And, it all kind of falls apart in his face.
Well, it's interesting because the first half of the film kind of builds him up as our almost a tragic hero, like a little bit of a martyr. Like, he's going through all these horrible things. He spent so much time in the military, this horrible military. He's seen mentors killed on the battlefield, and he's barely survived, but he's also saved his superiors. And he's just kind of manipulated by the system, and he's at the mercy of it. And then he finally is able to take charge, and he's kind of, I mean, he's a little bratty. It's funny. Again, it's kind of a comedy of, it's like a romantic comedy. He's in love with his cousin, and she's going to marry somebody else. So he, in a fit of rage, challenges this man to a duel. And it's just very, very, it's exaggerated in the way the performances are. They're very, lots of flourishes and drama, and it's very colorful. And it paints him as kind of like, he kills the guy, quote unquote, and then he has to escape, and he's on the run, and he gets caught up in all these different battles. But for the most part, despite his kind of selfishness, it's all for this nobility, like this noble cause of true love. I'm in love with my cousin. And he's painted as kind of a tragic hero. And then the second half of the movie kind of exploits his selfishness, and he becomes, kind of reveals himself as just kind of a terrible, terrible person.
I think I'm not quite sure what Kubrick's trying to get across, but I think in the end, the thing that outdoes him in just about everything is his inability to control his passions. The whole driving incident, he's so in love with his cousin, he does something really stupid that makes no logical sense. Him beating his son costs him, or stepson, causes him to lose pretty much everything, monetarily, support, friends, everything. His weakness in doting on his son causes his son to die.
Even
his humanity, of his mercy he shows at the end when instead of killing his stepson, he fires into the ground in an act of mercy. He should not have done that because it leads further to his ruin.
Leave it to Kubrick to make a movie about why humanity is a bad thing.
Well, no, I think it's, I don't know if it's a bad thing, but like in this horribly rigid, structured, very class-oriented society,
there's no place for
there is no place for humanity. And every time his humanity comes out, it costs him dearly.
Yeah.
For the most part.
And it speaks to kind of the production design and the structure of the film, how everything, because everything is framed so meticulously, as it should be, it's a Kubrick film.
Oh, yeah.
But especially in this, everything feels so much like you're looking at just these living portraits, living tapestries. And the people are just part of the background. And to separate yourself or to do something that pulls yourself away from your environment and puts you out there as a unique specimen or something thinking on your own terms is something that is completely at odds and deserving of punishment in this world.
Yeah. It's interesting that even his choice of there's a few handheld shots in the movie. Most of it's is on a tripod or a dolly, but the two that stand out to me, there's the fight scenes, which have a lot of handheld. There's an occasional when he's comes up on the highwayman who's going to rob him. It's handheld and has that tense feel. But the two that stand out for me are the shot of him beating his stepson, where it suddenly is. It feels like clockwork style, you know. As that
I got
rate
that vibe too
comes out, and then also Madame Linden after she poisons herself and is smashing the room and you know flailing
going
around.
Crazy, yeah,
again, it feels like a like camera work out of clockwork, as opposed to these very locked off, steady zoom shots and very structured sort of camera work. I feel like clockwork in this, despite the wild differences in style, kind of make up sister movies, I guess.
Yeah.
Like just in terms of the theme, and it's interesting. One is set in the distant past, and one is set in the future.
Yeah, and like you said, you pointed out that they are kind of dancing around the same topic,
exactly,
but in different extremes. And it's interesting that Kubrick wanted to go in the complete opposite direction after Clockwork Orange. And I know there was tons of controversy surrounding Clockwork Orange because it's a nuts movie and it's violent and horrific. But it is fascinating that he ends up then exploring the opposite. What happens in a world where emotion, the pendulum is swung to the other side and it's so bottled up that these people are just kind of like always on the verge of losing it, and every time they do something terrible happens. But it's almost like saying, is it any worse than having completely unbridled and unrestrained tendencies and access to those emotions and abilities to express that?
I think he's fascinated by the Enlightenment era. You have these two thinkers, you have Voltaire and Rousseau. Voltaire believes in a very ordered, structured society. He's kind of the figurehead of the Enlightenment. He believes reason and civilization are, you know, the prime goals of mankind. And he influences Frederick the Great of Prussia in how he organizes his society. And you have Rousseau, who believes in sort of a noble savage. Man is his most virtuous when he's free and wild and more of kind of a wild person than a civilized man.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you see Alex from Clockwork, who is, you know, very, you know, free, but he's completely a horrible monster. And you see people in Barry Lyndon who are completely slavishly rigid, and the neuroses that causes, and the society that just is stifling.
Yeah.
Like you feel almost just like you just want them to get the words out. They don't need to, like, even the highwayman who robs him is very proper and polite.
Yeah, but it's also, it's played for laughs. It's so funny. Oh, yeah. Like, again, I think what shocked me the most is the first part of the film. It is so, I recognize Kubrick, but at the same time, it's almost more passionate and almost a little loose. I know we've been talking about rigidity and how the film is very, very stiff in some ways because of the culture. Mm. But the first part of the film, there's a looseness to it and a kind of fun to it. And a lot of it comes, I think, from the cinematography and the sense of like the naturalistic lighting. It doesn't feel... Kubrick, once Kubrick really started, you know, with 2001 and all these movies, it like started turning into Kubrick. Everything feels so structured and almost artificial. But Barry Lyndon, for the first half, feels very sincere. There's a passion to it. I don't know necessarily that I get from 2001 or Clockwork Orange.
I think the first half, I think the reason it feels easier to grasp for you is, and I noticed this upon rewatching it, everything moves very quickly, despite each scene plays out very slowly and, you know, structured and very meticulous, holds on shots for long times. But I feel like every two shots, time passes and you're in a new location, something new is happening. The second half is mostly contained about within the drama of his manor and his household. And it definitely slows down in terms of just, you know, what's happening. And it focuses on a small cast of characters rather than kind of a journey.
Beyond that, I think it's also because he is static in those scenes as a character. He's not seeking really any growth. Like in the first part, he's constantly on the run, constantly trying to find his way out of his situation to survive, to do something.
Yeah.
And then at the second part of the film, he's married. It's just him in this family life. And it's kind of this boiling family drama. But the second half of the film, the second part of the film, feels more like a Kubrick film. I remember like the scene where his wife is in the bathtub and it's that slow zoom out and just that dead look in her eyes. I was like, oh, now it feels like Kubrick.
It's interesting when you have people who have kind of constant opportunities for growth and new paths, and they're unrooted and they're kind of, I don't know. Like ginger looks like the actual root like of ginger. It's all like there's no center to it. It's all just tangled like mess of sprouting different roots all kind of going into each other. It's really kind of, you know what I'm talking about? That sort of shape. It's kind of like that, where it's omnidirectional. There's no center. It's all over the place. And that's called a rhizome. A writer I like uses that as a metaphor for one way of living. And the other way is a tree. It has a center. It has, you know, roots. It has branches. It has a trunk that's a center to it. And that's another way of living. And you kind of look at it at the beginning. Barry's centerless. He's searching. There's constant new ways to sprout off and different lives to live. Mm-hmm. In the second half, he's rooted. He has a center, and it kind of deadens him because it contains what he can do, where he can go, and what he can become.
Yeah.
And in you see this deadness kind of even the first like shot of the second half of the movie, as it's him and his wife, his new wife, in their carriage. He's smoking a pipe and he like blows it in her face. And it's, you see this like this kind of like glassiness over his eyes, and you see this rootedness and centeredness and all that opportunity for, you know, trickery and going new directions and growth becomes very ossified. It becomes very arborescent, I guess.
But it also makes it very hard for me, at least upon first watching this movie, it makes it harder for me to really be invested in the second half because it's so disconnected in terms of what the first half of the movie sets up. It's kind of Kubrick's thing. I mean, there are examples to the contrary, but especially I compare it to Full Metal Jacket, where you have a film that is two distinctive halves, and one half is almost universally more praised than the other half. Barry Lyndon feels very similar to me, and it for a lot of the same reasons. It's been a long time since I've seen Full Metal Jacket, but that made it tough for me to really care about what happens in the second half, because for the most part I am with Barry and I'm kind of following him and I am invested in his journey. And then once we get into that kind of static like life where it's just like nothing is really happening and it's just kind of slow burning, and it that was tough for me. It was a tough transition. Did you get that at all the first time you watched it, or were you so impressed with the technique that that kind of overshadowed anything plot wise or story wise?
I barely remember the first time I saw it. It's been forever, but no, I don't know. I really was kind of fascinated with the direction they took it. And I remember just, you know, being just fascinated with every new shot. The thing that I stuck out to me this time watching it was at the very end, and maybe this just says something about me, but I was watching her sign those papers at the very end. Barry eventually goes to the New World, but they don't really say anything about that. And he gets a stipend every year from his, I guess, ex-wife. They're probably not divorced, but,
yeah,
you know, just 500 guineas or whatever for the rest of his life. And she's signing that paper, and just, again, maybe says more about me, but I just started to be like, all these people, obviously they're not real, but you know, this was years ago. They're all dead. Like this weird sort of existential, just like, I don't know, all this drama doesn't really matter. It's all in the past. Mm. And that end title card about everybody in the story being equal now, like, yes, they're all dead.
Yes.
I found that fascinating, and I never quite, I noticed it before, but I never like really took it in. I wonder what he's trying to say with that. Like, yeah. It's an interesting sort of idea that all this drama, like there's so much in history, there's so much human drama and grief and love and envy and all that, this emotion, and it's all just in the ground now. I don't know, maybe that says a lot more about me than the movie, but it's
no,
a fascinating
I think
thing.
That's an interesting point. It's I think that's not an inaccurate read of that epilogue at all. It's just tough to thematically, I'm not sure what Kubrick's trying to say overall. And that is one of many things he seems to be trying to say, in addition to the ideas of a rigid society and how humans just react to that, whether consciously or not, how they are trying to find some outlet for emotion, even if it isn't a healthy outlet for it.
Here's a theory. This is completely spitballing here, but maybe the whole epilogue about everybody being dead now is just saying, like, it's not worth living in a rigid, you know, structured society like that, where you're unable to express emotion except for extreme moments, and when it does, it costs you everything. Maybe he's saying, you have one life to live, and maybe you should seek human connection. You should seek strong feeling. You should seek authenticity, for a lack of a better word, and strive to create a society that privileges that. Because the life of Barry Lyndon seems like a pretty miserable life. Like even like the love scene at the very beginning, which is a bold way to start your movie with him and his cousin.
Yeah,
it's the most uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Awkward scene. Like the few moments of humanity that really shine through feel very, very sparse in this man's life. And I don't know, I feel like, wow, you lived, you know, 50-60 years in the society, and you bottled everything up your whole life. Mm-hmm. And now you're in the ground.
Maybe what Kubrick is trying to say is that everyone was dead the whole time. And M. Night Shyamalan totally ripped him off with The Sixth Sense.
I think that's exactly accurate. And I think he's totally not spinning in his grave hearing you say that.
So what's also interesting about Barry Lyndon, and I think part of why the first part of this film feels like there's so much passion in it, is because it's a lot of it is a little reminiscent of Napoleon, the pet project Kubrick never got to make, which I think was originally going to be his follow-up to Clockwork Orange, and yep, then things just fell through. And he took a lot of what he'd learned from researching for Napoleon and applied it to Barry Lyndon, and yep, you get the sense with the battle scenes, with just the production design, the costumes, the way he lovingly just kind of focuses on these masses of soldiers, these amazing shots and sequences and battles. Yeah. It's sad that he never got to make the movie he desperately wanted to, but at the same time, do you feel like Barry Lyndon kind of in some way offered a bit of closure there?
As much as I would love to see his Napoleon film, because Napoleon's a fascinating person, and Kubrick, this might, this may or may not be true, so don't email Sean all angry if I'm wrong on this. I heard this from a friend who's a huge movie nerd. He told me that Kubrick had a party trick where he had a like Dewey Decimal System, like a library file cabinet in his house, and each drawer was a year and had 365 cards in it. And each one of those cards had a day in Napoleon's life, and he had Napoleon's whole life there. And he would have somebody pull a card, tell him the date, and he would tell what Napoleon did on that day in his life. I don't know if that's true. I've just heard that from a friend, but he was obsessed with Napoleon, and he really wanted to make that movie. It got canceled because a movie called Waterloo came out around the same time. Didn't do too well in the box office, and the studio backed out of the project, but I would have loved to see his take on Napoleon.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I think Warner Brothers was expecting Barry Lyndon to be a big hit, and it wasn't really.
Yeah.
Did decent box office, but again, it was... Audiences were kind of lukewarm to it. Critics were kind of lukewarm to it. What do you think it was? Do you think it's kind of what my reaction is, just kind of feeling a little overwhelmed, a little uncertain about where it was going? Do you think it's the length? Do you think it's just the kind of how slow some of it feels? Some of the pacing really is glacial.
Well, I mean, the Jackie Brown comparison from earlier, like after you watch Pulp Fiction and you see Jackie Brown, you're like, what? That was boring and weird and slow. I mean, if you see Clockwork Orange and then you go into this expecting Clockwork Orange, it's not that.
Yeah.
It feels, and this is something I think I briefly mentioned while we were watching the movie, it feels like he is essentially making a film that somebody at the time would have made. Like, if they had the technology to make a movie, this is how they would structure it. This is how they would pace it. Did it feel like a novel to you? Did it feel like
That was a really great example.
Yeah.
It felt very lyrical. And it felt almost, again, maybe it is a little in tone with it, but I felt kind of like it was a fairy tale. The narration added that sort of, I'm telling you a story. It's almost, narration or voiceover tends to be frowned upon in certain cases. And for Kubrick to utilize it so heavily in this film, that caught me completely off guard.
It feels like a narrator in a novel.
Yes, it feels very much like, it lends the whole thing this kind of aura of, it's story time. I'm telling you almost a bedtime story.
Yeah.
It's not the best bedtime story. It's not comforting. But it felt, it gave it an air of like a fairy tale,
a parable.
Like, it did really feel like that. So yeah, I absolutely felt that, and also just the melodrama, the relationships, the way the different families are involved. Just, it did feel very literary to me.
It feels didactic, and it seems kind of what the message is, he's trying to impart to you with it. It feels almost as if, like, I personally, it feels almost like I'm not quite smart enough to suss out exactly what he's trying to say. And I get that with a lot of Kubrick films in a good way. Like, you know, there's a lot going on. I had the same feeling with Eyes Wide Shut, certain scenes in that with, for example, the scene where he's at the costumer's place and there's like the daughters having sex with guys. Like,
yeah.
And you feel like there's something trying to be said through that scene, like different scenes in that movie. And you're like, I wish I was a little bit smarter and I could just like grasp what he's
going
for.
Sometimes I wonder about that, though. Sometimes I wonder if the filmmaker wants you to think they're smarter than they are. Now, with Kubrick, it's something where there are enough examples of his genius where that I completely agree. I think there's something to it. But there are some cases where I think filmmakers are like, yeah, there's something there. And it's like, no, there's not. Shut up.
I think almost everything with Kubrick is, for one of my favorite little Kubrick things, this is something, again, I have no confirmation of my own personal theory, but in The Shining, during the opening scenes with the helicopter shots in the mountains, you can see the shadow of the helicopter at certain points. And I think Kubrick was aware of that, just being the perfectionist he was. And in Full Metal Jacket, there's a shot on like a hillside or a mountain, and the first thing you see is a shadow of a helicopter before you go up to the helicopter itself. And again, like little details where I'm just like, I feel like he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
I feel like this was a little in joke to anybody who saw that shadow in his personal little way to just be like, I know, you know, it, I don't know, like just little levels of genius in all of his films where I think nothing was by mistake or anything like that.
Absolutely. So what do you think Barry Lyndon, I guess the obvious answer is the cinematography, but what do you think Barry Lyndon offers us in Kubrick's filmography that nothing else in it does? That's my first thought is the cinematography, the emphasis on the zooms, and particularly just, I think really the first part of it, the passion on display is very humanistic in a way that reminds me of Paths of Glory almost, where it felt very human before things get really dark and dreary in the second part. But what do you think Kubrick does here that he doesn't necessarily, you don't see elsewhere?
Well, first of all, I think it's probably the best movie like I know of set at that time. Like it really, if you love period stuff, if you love costumes, if you love setting, if you want to feel like what it felt like to really live in that time period, it captures that, like little moments that feel very real. Like even the characters shaving or bathing,
it doesn't feel artificial at all. I think that was the purpose behind a lot of his decisions with the lighting and with the design, the production design.
To me, I find his fascination with societal control and freedom and kind of passion versus reason. These are deep questions, and you know we've been trying to figure it out for centuries. And the Enlightenment, in that era of sort of a rigid, logical approach to structuring a society and structuring human experience, I think those are questions that are still with us, even in you know this kind of postmodern era. And I think it's worth kind of revisiting and seeing kind of a genius artist take on these questions in a beautifully done film. And honestly, I know that you weren't fond of the second half, like, but there is lots to be enjoyed there. There is like really interesting drama and strife and you know, I would recommend at the intermission, take an hour off, clear your head, you know, come back to it fresh. Yeah. You know, it's
a tough movie, and it feels, Kubrick doesn't mess around. It feels like the second half is intentionally challenging for reasons I'm not sure about, and I'm sure won't be revealed to me until I watch it again.
Yeah, and to be honest, like one of my favorite scenes is in the second half. I love when
there's some great stuff. I don't like want to dismiss the second half. There's some great stuff in it.
When Brian the child dies, that scene where he's asking about if he's going to go to heaven, and just really just raw, like beautiful acting, really really moving scene, like surprisingly so. Like you know, you feel yourself kind of welling up with emotion as a father kind of has to lie to his son that he's going to get better when he knows he's going to die. Mm-hmm. It's powerful stuff. And it's, again, like just a really interesting story about the rise and fall of this person. And
yeah, I love the relationship and the resolution of him and his stepson.
Yeah.
And, what that, I do love, again, Barry Lyndon makes pretty terrible choices and behaves pretty despicably.
Yeah.
But when he has the chance to kill this guy who has been causing him so much grief, he doesn't, which is an honorable thing. And it costs him, but it's almost as if he knows he's either going to die or he's going to be badly injured.
And
he chooses not to shoot him anyway, which is, it feels like an acceptance maybe of his faults and his errors and his willingness to say like, yes, I deserve to be punished.
Yeah.
And it's a completion, I guess, of his arc in a way.
It's redemptive. And it's he starts out the movie dueling in a fit of anger, shoots somebody who did him really no wrong.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the movie, it's very subtle, but it's one moment, a glimpse of him essentially turning the other cheek, a glimpse of him, you know, not taking the opportunity to kill somebody who definitely has wronged him. And, you know, I love that both of them have grievance. Both of them, Barry Lyndon is kind of a despicable person, and his son is a bratty, horrible, little sniveling, you know, he has a horrible looking face.
He does. He reminded me, the child version of him reminded me of Damien from The Omen. For a split second, I thought it was the same kid. But he does have that kind of face where you just want to slap him. But to be fair, I don't think a lot of his horrible behavior comes from Barry's cheating on his mom and being kind of a despicable guy in the first place. So I empathized with him, even as I kind of am like, dude, just chill. Like, can't we all just get along?
Yeah, he's definitely, he has right to be, you know, upset with everything, because Barry's kind of destroying his fortune and making it so, you know, what's rightfully his is kind of being squandered. But at the same time, it's just, he's not approaching it with any tact or, you know, any sort of, I don't know, the piety or uprightness. No. They're
both fighting for the affection of the mom, basically. Yeah. Like, they are rivals to win her heart.
And the money and the wealth and the yes. title and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. I again, it's a visual feast.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't know if you've done enough favors. I don't think I've done enough favors. It's a hell of a lot of fun.
Yes.
Like it really is. It's not as dry and boring as we're making it sound. It's
I think the first half especially is real strong. The second half is tough. I mean, I think it is. I didn't feel the link so much in the first half, but the second half I was like, okay, all right, gotta push through. Maybe it's because it's pushed. We were pushing towards midnight around that time, but I definitely started to feel its length.
This is my fourth or fifth time watching it now, and I did not feel the length till the very last scene. And at that point, and I knew it was just because I was tired. Like I personally find it all just kind of riveting.
So where ultimately would you rank it, do you think, if you could rank Stanley Kubrick's movies?
You keep asking me this. I can't rank them. I they all kind of stand alone, and they all are just so wildly different. It's definitely like in his everything past, like Doctor Strangelove and beyond most of his movies are masterpieces. I would say Doctor Strangelove and beyond are kind of his best work. All those movies, like, they're just so radically different.
Yeah.
I can't. 2001, I think, is probably his best film, and it's just because of how big the concepts are and how abstractly he handles them and how beautifully it's done. But I really love all of his movies, and yeah, I can't rank them. It's like ranking my children. I can't do that. But
I guess, yeah, I'm with you on that, as we've discussed before, but 2001 is, I think, always going to be my favorite. This ranks lower for me, but lower only in terms of preference. I don't know necessarily that it's one of my favorites or if it will ever be one of my favorites, but it's still fascinating and absolutely worth seeing. So I guess, if there's nothing else to say, final ratings, we'll just do, I guess, let's do candlesticks, because the candlelight is such a revolutionary technique in this film. How many candlesticks will you give Barry Lyndon on a scale from 1 to 5?
Well, I would have to say like 200, because that's how many candles he used in the movie. I just real fast. I know we're in the rating period right now, yeah. And there's strict rules, and you know I gotta follow the guidelines.
It's almost one. It is 1 a.m.
Or I'll get caned. but I just gotta say, to me, and this sounds crazy, I feel like Clockwork Orange feels longer to me. Just like the prison scene and on. It just, to me, it feels like it drags.
Okay.
But like this, I feel like this flows. Again, maybe just personal preference, but every Kubrick movie post Dr. Strangelove is a 5 candlestick,
yeah,
all the way.
I think personally I would give it 3.5, but if I'm looking at it as a work of art, I'd probably give it a 4. I'd go ahead and bump it up to 4. I still think the second half suffers from the lack of a real strong through line to get us to keep us moving. It definitely slows down, but it's stunning. I loved the cinematography for this.
Do you have a favorite shot?
God, the opening shot, like the second, like you see them framed against the sky and the trees, and just the every single zoom, it always starts in close on the people, and then you pull out to see the landscape around them. All of that was just stunning. But I think the shots of the soldiers, maybe just the battle scenes, like all that stuff, just to orchestrate that is insane. But the way he shows them marching, it's just, man, it's great. And then again, there's so much beauty in this movie, and it feels unique in that a lot of it feels more naturalistic than a lot of Kubrick's work. A lot of his stuff feels meticulously framed, and it's always like, structurally, there's a kind of an equilibrium to it, and the shaping, you know, and these, there are moments like this or moments like that, but it feels so natural. And the fact that it was lit mostly naturally really contributes to that. It doesn't feel as artificial in a way.
It's amazing what a guy who, you know, you think of with elaborate sets and neon lighting and stuff can do with trees and a stream and some grass and some people in it.
Yeah.
My favorite shot is my number one shot, and I always, whenever it comes up, I just mentally, my brain just goes, wow, is when after he gets his horse stolen at the very beginning and he's walking along, you see dark clouds.
Oh, the storm cloud. Yeah.
And it's just, it looks like it's like nothing you've ever seen before. It looks like a painting. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, it's a fascinating film and absolutely worth seeing for any fan of Kubrick. And
or film.
It's definitely, like,
or
you said,
history.
It's kind of an underdog in his filmography, but it's like, it should be. Yeah, it deserves to be part of that group
that
we're talking
about.
Yeah, Dr. Strangelove and Clockwork Orange and all those. It should be in that conversation.
For sure.
But great. Thank you for showing me. I'm glad I can cross that off my list now. Thank you. And I guess if people want to find you on the internets, where can they find you?
Oh, gee, I don't have Facebook and all Twitter. I am on Instagrams.
If they want to challenge you to a duel,
challenge me to a duel, and I'll quiver and throw up, and cock my gun and have it go off, and be upset that I can't get another shot.
It's perfect story of my life.
Let's see. My Instagram is at Daniel M. Rainer. That's R-A-I-N-E-R. And if you want to see pretentious black and white street photography, it's Dan Rainer Photography on Instagram.
And of course they do. That you don't even have to ask. And I'm at Yay Sean Doorman on Twitter. And feel free to reach out to us. Tell us what you think about Barry Lyndon and whether or not it does deserve its reputation as one of Kubrick's best films. And also find the Nerd Party. That's the network Missing Frames is a part of, in case you didn't already know. There's tons of great stuff going on there. Tons of great podcast shows about Doctor Who, Star Trek, Star Wars, film, television, everything you can possibly imagine. You can go to thenerdparty.com. You can also follow The Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party on Twitter and like the Facebook page, The Nerd Party. And if you like what you're listening to, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, because that helps out a lot. And we thank you for it. We thank you for listening. Dan, let's go to sleep.
I gotta go home first. I'm not gonna sleep at your house.
We've been through so much.
Okay, I'll sleep with the cat on the couch. Do you mind if I light a bunch of candles before I go to bed?
Yeah, let's light some candles and go to bed.